Hey everybody, Melissa McKenzie, publisher of the American Spectator, here again with our education symposium here in sunny Palm Beach, Florida. I almost said California, I don't know why, in Florida. And we have had up to this point Peter Schweitzer as a guest and then Carol Markowitz as a guest. So if you're seeing this as a recorded podcast later, go and make sure and check those out. And of course, like and subscribe and everything else at the American Spectator. So now we are joined with our special guest, and you'll notice he is young and he is new. This is our newest American Spectator writer. He will be having a podcast with us, a newsletter, everything. Nate Hockman, welcome. And this is the first time we've met in person.
That's right. Yeah, that's the nature of conservative media, as you know, everyone online.
Exactly.
But you're much, much more rare for you to actually meet them in person.
Exactly. So Nate is going to be, he's got his reputation precedes him. And I have been an admirer of your work for a couple of years now, for as long as I've seen your work. And I'm really, really glad to have you on the team. And I'm very excited about the future. If you all who are listening don't know, the American Spectator has two missions. One is obviously the best conservative news and commentary in the business. The second thing is that we have a young writers program. And for us, having young people, because when Bob Terrell started the magazine, he was in college still. And so for us, having young people work for the magazine is not a, it's a bonus. It's part of what we do. It's part of what we want to do. And now Nate came out of college as kind of a rock star. And in my view, still is a rock star, which is why we have him at the American Spectator. So Nate, what I wanted to talk to you specifically about, because you are closer to the educational system and you have been through this world, I wanted to talk to you about your perspective having just come through it. We have on our staff, we have a Notre Dame grad, a Hillsdale grad. We've had one of our best writers was from Wesleyan. All across the Fruited Plains, we've had young people who have either come through really difficult educational situations or supportive ones if they went to some place like Hillsdale or like Grove City. How was it for you?
So I went to a small liberal arts college in Colorado Springs called Colorado College, pretty much sort of quintessential, if you think sort of standard small liberal arts college, about 2,000 kids. It's more or less within that sort of demographic, very left wing. I was, I think, the only really outspoken conservative on campus. And I was, just for context, I was raised liberal. I mean, I love my parents to death. It wasn't, you know, crazy left wing or anything, but they were Clinton Democrats. We grew up in Portland, Oregon, which isn't exactly a bastion of right wing politics. And I sort of figured out that I was a conservative around late high school, early college.
How did you figure it out?
Well, a lot of it was sort of oppositional originally, right? So it was a instinctive alienation from everything I was seeing at my very left-wing high school and then subsequently my very left-wing college. And the first impulse before I even sort of figured out that there was such a thing as a sort of conservative worldview was just that whatever these guys are, I'm not that, right? Mm-hmm. These people are crazy and this is not the sort of political side that I'm on. And then you sort of, that obviously leads you down the rabbit hole. You start reading different conservative thinkers. I was lucky enough to have one really good conservative professor who gave me, you know, all of the sort of greats, Russell Kirk, Michael Oakeshott, mm-hmm. Strauss. And then you sort of start to sort of unpack that and you are in a very left-wing environment. So you're kind of seeing conservative critiques of the left-wing worldview play themselves out in real time. So in many ways, I was really lucky to sort of have that experience. But the campus was extremely left-wing. And there were other students, often, you know, kids on the athletic teams, kids in Greek life, kids who are on scholarship were much more likely to be conservative than very wealthy sort of San Franciscans. But obviously because the sort of reigning campus orthodoxy was extremely left-wing, and especially at a small college, social conformity matters. There are real sort of social consequences for being labeled as a right-winger.
So such as?
Well, you know, you don't get let into parties. People in general don't like you, right? The word gets out, and you can kind of get away with that if you're at a college of 30,000 people, although I'm sure it's still hard, but a small campus of 2,000 people, you know, very quickly your reputation becomes someone who has all these evil political views, right? And that's a big deal. I sort of, by junior year, I had sort of made my peace with that, and I didn't really care. And I had a good sort of friend group. I didn't care anyways. But I, you know, did the whole sort of starting a conservative magazine, et cetera, et cetera. And we had our run-ins with left-wing activists and all that good stuff. But for me, maybe just because I'm sort of an instinctive contrarian, that made me more right-wing. Again, largely sort of initially oppositional, right? So just sort of angry at left-wingers for being who they were. But it was, I think it in many ways, it was characteristic of the experience of any, not just conservative, but sort of ideologically heterodox kid going through a sort of standard left-wing campus, which is, you know, you're the only person in the classroom or the only person at, you know, the table in the dining hall or whatever who has these political views, and you have to sort of navigate the situation accordingly.
It's interesting. You brought up the one professor. My daughter was going through a public university in Texas and kind of going through her agnostic phase, and which she knew like drove me absolutely crazy, like want to send me to the funny farm, pretend that God doesn't exist, or you're just not, you know, flip your hair and say, I'm just not sure, mom. Okay. So that, I'm sure you all know how that conversation went. And so I'm having to bite my tongue and pray that God brings the right person into her life. Well, two professors actually helped her get to the right place. And this is in a public university. One was so psychotically lefty and had them read like Foucault and all this. And she was like, no, like it was reflexively no. And then she had another professor who was a C.S. Lewis scholar. And he suggested that he didn't force anything. He's like, well, you might want to read this, 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 and this. And she read the philosophers. She by that time, and it wasn't just mom, you know, telling her. So it's kind of a bright spot, isn't it? Even in a sea of, I think that the problem now with the college professors is you can't even get into a PhD program if you are not heterodox left. It's so tough. We had one young writer working for us for a while, and he wanted to go into a PhD program eventually, and decided ultimately not to, because he didn't think there was any path for him to even do that in the kind of literature and political science. I'm not sure exactly what he wanted to do. What do you think about that?
It's certainly true of academia. And I mean, I had a sort of phase because I was a political theory major, and that's what sort of I caught the bug for, where I was thinking about, well, maybe, you know, what do I do after college? Maybe I go get a master's or a PhD and think about academia. And my one conservative professor told me, basically, he's like, you know, I'm an academic, obviously. I think it's a wonderful pursuit for all of these reasons. And I think that you would benefit from it. But just be aware, not only are you conservative, but you're a straight white man, right? And that makes it extremely difficult, if not impossible, to get into one of the sort of top PhD programs. And that's not even to mention the sort of job market problems, right? Where you to get a good job, you really need to be from one of the top PhD programs, or at least have a good shot. In terms of the sort of broader campus environment, I think the experience depends significantly on the kind of kid that you're sending into it, right? Mm-hmm. So again, for me, as someone who is sort of a rebellious teenager going into it, funnily enough, the sort of paradigm up until now is like you have the rebellious teenager from the sort of conservative family and they become left-wing and godless in college. Mm-hmm. And mine was the opposite, as I was a Portland, Oregon kid from a left-wing family, and my rebellion was to become extremely right-wing, right? Mm-hmm. So it was an inversion, but I actually don't think that my experience was unique in that sense, in that, and this is starting to actually be reflected in the polling. If you look at Gen Z young men specifically, they're not just moving right wing, they're moving right wing at a breakneck speed by some polls. Funnily enough, if you look at the left wing young women, they're becoming even more left wing, right? So there's this amazing graph that came out from a polling place that's been doing this for years of the political ideology of 12th grade boys and the political ideology of 12th grade girls, liberal, conservative, right? And the conservatism of 12th grade boys is going like that, and it's going like that for young women. So that's going to create all kinds of weird dating dynamics. But particularly for young men, who are coming in, not necessarily conservative, a lot of times like me from sort of liberal backgrounds, I watched a lot of young men just at my college alone, even if they weren't as political as I was, A, having this visceral negative reaction mm-hmm. to what they're seeing on campus. And then if they were interested and in actually sort of exploring and unpacking it, eventually ending up on the political right self-consciously. But even among the average young man who wasn't particularly political and wasn't really interested in talking about this stuff, there was this instinctive, you know, sense that, well, this is crazy, right? Like if you went into mm-hmm. a fraternity, or you went into like the hockey house or the basketball house or whatever, and you get the guys behind closed doors and there aren't girls around, you know, within a few minutes, they'll start sounding like Rush Limbaugh if you ask them about mm-hmm. like the gender pronoun requirements or something.
Right.
So that is something that is very much an undercurrent among young men. And I've written about this before. I think because it hasn't quite made itself known in the polling yet, we're only just starting to see it. A lot of conservatives, I don't think, are even fully aware that it is an undercurrent. The task, I think, for political conservatives is to tease that out, because you have a lot of apolitical young men who it's like a resting disposition, right? Where they're like, well, yeah, that stuff is crazy. It's just sort of an assumption, but they haven't fully followed that basic sort of pre-ideological sense to its logical conclusion. I was lucky enough to sort of be able to do that, but I think that's certainly a dynamic that's going to become more and more potent in American politics over the next couple of decades.
Well, it's interesting because the polling that you're talking about, the Scott and I, Scott McKay, who is here off camera, everybody, you know, the spectacle, my podcast partner, and we talked about that polling, and the men have moved less than the women. The women have really gone off the deep end. What's interesting still, though, is that when women get married and have children, they moderate almost immediately, because all of the baloney that they're taught, say, for example, about, you know, it's how you're socialized. Well, you have a boy and he comes out of you like a rocket and then acts like an animal. You can have hear all the theory about how this is socialization, or you can know actually, well, I have a girl and she's sweet and she literally, my husband at the time burped and my daughter cried. My son at the exact same phase, of like figured out that his body could make a fart and started laughing as a baby. He's like, this is the best thing ever. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. Anyone who says boys and girls aren't different, you know, is crazy. And that really becomes clear once you've had, you know, children, once a woman gets married and has kids. Although I would say, and this is a challenging thing, as a mother of sons, the girls have gotten crazier, and alarmingly so. But there's a few rare exceptions. And so for the lucky men who find these girls, you know, good for you. But it is going to be a challenge going forward, I think, because there are just so many things that they're taught that are just not so.
Right. And to your point, women do become more conservative when they get married and kids. The problem is today's women, partially because they've mm-hmm. been socialized into this, you know, anti-family, anti-patriarchal culture, are not getting married and having kids, right?
Right.
So the sort of classic formula everyone's heard, right? If you're not a Democrat when you're 20, you have no heart. If you're not a Republican when you're 30, you have no brain.
Mm-hmm.
The classic formula for every generation since we've had public opinion polling was that they became more conservative as they got older. And for millennials, they were the first generation on record who have not moved right as they've gotten right. older. And
because they have evil boomers for parents. Sorry, guys.
No, anyway. No boomer hate on this. But the but I think the obvious fact of why that's happening is that it's not like there's something magical when you hit the age 30 where you become more right wing.
Well,
it's
you do pay more taxes.
Well, but it's the social conditions associated right. with being older, right? So you right. get married, you have kids, you buy a house, right? Mm-hmm. That was the classic sort of American dream formula. It makes you more conservative. All of the available public opinion polling shows this. So it wasn't that people were getting older and the wisdom that, you know, they accumulate with age makes them more conservative.
Right.
Maybe that was happening on the margins. It's because they were getting married, having kids, paying a mortgage, sending their kids to local schools. They didn't want their kid to get shot, you know, mm-hmm. walking on down the street to school. They wanted, you know, they didn't want their kids to get right. taught things that they hated, all of that stuff. Those things have a way of sobering the mind and sort of curbing some of the, you know, youthful utopian impulses. That's not happening. So millennials aren't becoming more right wing. The interesting thing about Zoomers, Gen Z, getting more right wing, at least on the male side, is that it is coming from a totally different formula than the getting married, buying a house and having kids, because they're not doing it either, at least, you know, not sort of en masse. It's a counter reaction from young men to, especially young white men, to a having grown up in a culture that openly hates them, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're a young man with the capacity for critical thinking and sort of healthy testosterone levels,
right?
How else are you going to react to that, right? You are going to reject it, especially because there's something innate in young adolescent men where they are boisterous, they are combative, you know, they are looking to sort of...
I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't...
As the mother of young men.
Yeah, I'm an 18-year-old right now.
Right.
He's in college and he's my most radical.
Yeah.
He's absolutely radicalized. And I think seeing how he was schooled and the response of the insanity up close and personal, it's one thing for those of us who are older to hear about this transgender craze and to, you know, the problems with the rainbow people and all this stuff. It's another thing to face it and live with it and have friends who will say to them, you know, like he came home in middle school. He goes, this kid got transferred in from California, right? Mom, my new friend, I forget the kid's name, probably good. He's bisexual. And I just burst out laughing. I was like, in all his vast experience as a 12 or 13 year old, you know, it's like he knows this about himself. Really? Has he hit puberty yet? I'm like, come on. You know, by the time the kid was through high school, you know, he had a girlfriend and all that stuff. Now, I mean, but having that up close, you know, and then that same kid, his parents didn't want him in school. And he said to him, but you're coming to cross country practice. Why aren't you coming to school? The next day, the kid goes home and says to his daft liberal parents, I want to go back to school. And they're like, okay. But I mean, because it's just so insane. You know, it's just that insanity really radicalized him.
Right. And that's sort of what I was getting at earlier, is that it is initially at least a pre-ideological reaction,
right?
It's not, you don't even have the words or the terms to describe this sort of visceral reaction you're having. That's what it was like for me. That's what it was like for a lot of young men I know. And, you know, I keep in touch with a lot of my buddies from college, and a lot of them are sort of standard, you know, frat guys, or they played a sport or something like that, you know, decent sort of, normal, you know, good looking guys, like who aren't totally deranged for one way or another. And I mean, the group chats I'm in with them now, like, it's like these guys, you know, sometimes they scare me, right? Like, it's like, it's, they're that right wing. And that is, again, that sort of anecdotal thesis that I had, which we're now starting to see in the polling, has just been confirmed time and time again, every time I run into sort of environments or situations with young men. And it is a different kind of conservatism in a way, because it is not, like we talked about, the sort of conventional.
It's not grounded in philosophy. It's not grounded in experience. It's grounded in antipathy for the cultural norms.
And a kind of radicalism as a result of that. And I don't think it necessarily an irrational radicalism.
No.
And you know, some of these people, a lot of times they do find sort of right-wing political philosophy. But even there, their sort of understanding of it is very different than it was for, I think, you know, conservatives in the 1990s or whatever. I think, you know, who knows what that's going to look like in 20 years, but I think that we're potentially looking at a sort of earthquake level political influence when these people sort of become of age. They become whatever, bankers, professors, lawyers.
They'll become nothing and like it because of the DEI hiring policies in the corporate world right now, as it stands, where a white guy is not even allowed into management training programs and that sort of thing, where they're focusing totally on women and people of color to the exclusion of white men. And so it's a strange thing. I think it's almost like in like the Amish or the Jewish community or whatever, where they have to become entrepreneurs, small business owners to have any kind of success that they might like. It's something that I've considered a lot because my son is probably going to go into the private sector. And how is that going to look for him? You know, considering now an interesting thing happened with my kids, that they didn't get scholarships because they were white, right? To undergrad. even though their scores were amazing, right? And this was my son-in-law too, but they all got scholarship to grad school. So their grad schools got paid for. So in grad school, it was still merit-based. They didn't want the dummies, okay? Evidently, the undergrad, the dummies can get in if they are the right color, the right whatever.
And flunk out.
But the grad schools gave them scholarships, which I found fascinating. Now, what that means, you know, and how are they going to make and move in their private life, having a career? I don't know, but I am concerned about that because the millennials who, as a generation, are starting to run things. I'm part of Gen X. We're too small. There's just not enough of us. But my Gen Z kids had an interesting perspective. They're like, for whatever reason, we get along with the Gen X people well.
This is my experience too. Gen X is a remarkably healthy, functional generation. I don't know exactly if it's just you're wedged between two totally dysfunctional generations. My parents are Gen X too, and they're classic. Like, you know, they lived more or less like a sort of perfect American life. You know, got married, stayed married, had kids, upper middle class. That's most Gen Xers, I think. It's I don't know what they put in the water around the time you guys were getting born, but you guys
were Reagan babies. We had our formative years were by Reagan, and we didn't know it at the time, but we were pre-technology. When I was in high school, we've got the internet was not even just a thing yet. That happened in college, and the first word processing program. So I still learned to type on a typewriter. The next year I took basic to code. So that was just a new thing in school. And so there was that, and we had free time. We didn't have phones. No one was tracking us anywhere. And I know these two bozos were bad to the bone when the stuff that we did, just as a general rule, this is Paul Kanger and Scott McKay who are here in the room. And me as a Gen Xer, we just had so much freedom, even though my parents were totalitarians, but I still got away with all kinds of stuff because they just could not possibly track me everywhere.
Well, and the fascinating thing is Reagan was the last Republican president to win the youth vote. Well, I mean, H.W. Bush won it, but he's really sort of, in general, H.W. Bush was running on the sort of fumes of the Reagan coalition, right?
Right.
And he won the 18 to 24-year-old vote by a larger margin than his national median vote, right? So he was he did better with them than he did with his overall margins. And it's fascinating, especially as someone who's born in 1998, to go back and sort of read, you know, New York Times reports on like Reagan courts the youth vote, right? It's totally foreign to our sort of political framework today. And you've got all these interviews with college kids who are like, I might not agree with him on abortion or whatever, but you know, he's a patriot, something like that, something to that effect. And that again is a totally different youth culture than the one that we live in today, certainly.
Well, the thing is I do think that the Republicans, if they're smart, they should be courting the male vote, the young men. And because they are radicalized, but they are lazy when it comes to coming out to the polls.
Young people are in general, just to be, you know, just to invoke both genders. But yeah, you're right. Absolutely.
That is true. However, what the left has done, and I know this because somehow, whoever you are, this person who put me on this list, you know, a pox on your house. But anyway, they thought that I was my daughter. Mm-hmm. So I was receiving all the messaging, the Obama messaging around the election stuff and, you know, abortion. They're trying to take this away from you. And so like the young women are being really heavily, consistently courted. That's true. They did go out to the polls both in 2020 and in 2022. The young men though.
And the young men that did show up were disproportionately left-wing ones, right? I mean, that was one of the interesting things is you've got all this polling showing that young men are moving right, often by quite drastic margins. And then in 2022, the actual exit poll breakdown was that young men were still significantly more left-wing. And, you know, people like Matt Iglesias did the Substack about this going, oh, you know, goes to show all that polling is nonsense. It's like, no,
yeah,
it's not.
No,
just
it's
that
not.
The disassociated, alienated contingents of young men, you know, they're totally alienated from the political process. They don't trust any of our dominant institutions. I don't blame them.
Right.
And they're not, especially in a midterm year, right? They're not going to show up to vote for what, right? So Republicans do need to find ways to sort of identify and mobilize those constituencies, especially, again, as they become older. And, you know, some of them buy houses and get married. But regardless, as they become people who are just demographically more likely to be involved in the political process, because, again, a lot of them right now, they are right wing without fully self-consciously knowing they're right wing, right? So you have to first convince them that they are what they are, and then actually sort of turn them into loyal GOP based voters.
Well, the other thing is too, is that at that developmental age too, it's a difficult time for a young man where they don't have a job yet. They're not sure what they want to do. They're still self-developing a little bit, you know, lagging. And if they're having a good time in college and partying or whatever, they're not, you know, and they're not really thinking big picture like this. And so, but it is important. And I, you know, just, I think with the online culture, I'd like to ask you about this. Talking to the opposite sex, social interaction that used to be like in my generation, you know, if a guy wanted to call a girl for a date, he had to possibly go through a father or mother who answered the phone in my generation, or your sibling was on the other end of the line going, hey, and listening to you talk to your boyfriend. I mean, all kinds of torment happened, at least in my household. And that kind of direct kind of challenge for a guy doesn't exist. So there's a lot of online dating, if there's a dating at all. And then in person, the socialization is more challenging. My son was complaining about his brothers at his frat. You know, he's like, find a girl and bring her, you know. So he brought like 15 girls to a party that they were having. He's like, and if you guys don't end up with dates after this, I'm like, you know, gonna be mad at you. Yeah, he's bringing the ladies so that they can like have some social interaction. But he's like hyper social. That, you know, I think the online world is a lot more insular and has made it more difficult to build those skills and gain that confidence. So what do we do? What do we do?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, my experience here has been skewed. So I don't think it's representative, like the experience of the average 25-year-old boy in America. Because, well, first of all, I was in college and then I was in DC and I was in DC conservative circles. So the social life there actually for young conservatives is quite good. It's quite healthy. And it's inextricably connected to platforms like Twitter, right? I met a lot of my friends through Twitter. And the sort of the line between like the online sphere and the real life sphere is very blurry. People constantly move between them. But in the sort of in the real world, in the world outside of that sort of constructed environment, I mean, I think dating apps are huge, right? And whether or not that's good, I think is open for debate. I think it's probably bad. But I think that there's a sort of been a decline of like the sort of traditional mechanisms and civic institutions that not just allow young men and young women to meet, but then encourage them to actually commit and then get married, and social norms also, right? That expect them, that understand that there's something shameful about not doing that, right? All of that has totally deteriorated. So not only are young men and young women not meeting in the first place, but the ones who are, the social norms are the inverse now, right? Where there is something weird or shameful about actually expecting some sort of long-term commitment. So that's, I think, a much sort of bigger picture issue that probably characterizes the environment a lot of young men and young women are living in.
I think that the women in particular, have you seen those videos like on YouTube where, and I don't know who the guy is, but he brings these, you know, interviews these girls and they're like, yeah, girls are the same as guys. And he's like, really? You know, like, and they talk about the difference between, there's this real kind of, And my son again has shown me all this. He's like, Mom, look at this. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this girl, you know, like, no, she's not the same. No, it's not going to go well for her if she has 200 partners before she gets married. It's just not. And yet having these, you know, this kind of belief system that they're indoctrinating in, and it's happening for girls way young. We talked in the last segment about kind of the socialization in elementary school. The segment before that was the corruption of the colleges themselves. All throughout all of this are just lies. I wrote a piece about how young women are lied to almost right from the beginning. And that so many social ills that we're seeing from infertility, 30% of infertility is undiagnosed STDs in women. And so like they delay motherhood, they delay marriage, they finally get around to wanting to have a kid, you know, oh, maybe after a career at 40, and then hit a wall. So you're part of the younger generation who's radically against this. Our next issue, which you wrote for, of the American Spectator, subscribe now. We talk about religion and how that has been a major influence for, and I'm seeing this at the churches, the church level, the young people being so conservative in a way that I even didn't grow up. So what do you think is happening there?
Oh, that's totally evident. I mean, it's tougher to capture some of these things in like actual sort of surveys or public opinion polls because they're more localized. One of the actual sort of like hard data evidence we have of it is Latin Mass in Catholic churches, where the average age in Latin Mass is something absurdly low. And you see that if you go to a Latin Mass or if you know people, they go to a Latin Mass, right? It's all kids my age or slightly older who are married and have multiple kids already. But it's true of conservative Protestant churches as well.
Yeah.
And it totally gives the lie to the fundamental defining logic of theological liberalization in, you know, the mainline Protestant denominations, which is we need to change with the times in order to appeal to the new generation. Well, you did the opposite, right? If you go to an Episcopalian service, and you know, my mom is Episcopalian, so I have a certain amount of residual affection for the Episcopalian liturgy. But if you go to Episcopalian service, every head in the room, and there's only like three or four, is gray,
right?
It's a few sort That's of octogenarians who still trundle out of bed every Sunday to go hear a liturgy and a theology that's effectively indistinguishable from the platform of the Democratic Party at any given moment.
Yeah.
If you go to, you know, just for one-to-one comparison, if you go to like an Anglican Church in America service, which is the conservative answer to Episcopalianism, in DC at least, it's 29 and 30-year-olds who are married and have two kids in tow, right? And that's true of, you know, if you have like the conservative Lutheran denominations, obviously the conservative non-denominational churches, it's all young people, and the pews are filled, right? And the obvious, again, it seems totally logical to me. It's sort of baffling to me that people who have pushed for theological liberalization didn't see this and still don't. The obvious truth is that if you are a young person who, especially if you're coming from a secular background, and you are drawn to religion, is because you want something that is separate from the culture. And especially in a moment of enormous alienation and uncertainty, where all of the old certainties are now open questions, right? And all of the questions that we used to have answers to, we can't answer anymore. You want something which is capital T true. It has been true for as long as humans have existed. It will be true for as long as the earth exists, right? It is the same thing people believed 2,000 years ago, and it will be the same thing people believe in 2,000 years. And a church that marries the spirit of this age will be a widow in the next, right? That's the sort of the heuristic.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely true that all of the churches that tried to marry the spirit of the age are not offering anything unique or different or concrete to the young people who are drawn to religion. If you're a young person, why would you get out of bed on every Sunday morning to go hear the same thing, the same talking points that you hear from every other dominant institution in American life? The reason that you are drawn to that is because you want to hear something different, and you want a sense of certainty and answers to the open questions that the culture now has. So it's totally common sense. And again, just my experience, and this is sort of conventional wisdom amongst anyone who sort of traffics in these circles, is the places that are blowing up in terms of membership and that have lots and lots of young people and are dynamic and energetic are the really conservative churches. And the ones that are dying are the mainline Protestant liberal ones.
That's certainly been my experience. And that whole answer is why we hired Nate Hockman. I just want to let you know. I got a little excited right there, Nate. But it's true. And like in the parish that I'm in, there's 30,000 people in the parish. And last week at the service, there was 200 people at the front who are coming in from other denominations. So this is another trend that nobody's really talking about. So all these people, they talk about the nuns. Well, the nuns have been nuns for a while. Right. And it, they haven't been nuns because, and I don't mean N-U-N, I mean N-O-N-E-S, the nun, the religious nuns who've left the Lutheran Church or left the Episcopalian Church and have floated for a while and are trying to figure out what to do with themselves. And they're starting to find homes and they're starting to go to the places that are holding to the truth. And the interesting thing is, and we talk about it in the next magazine coming up. So if you're not a subscriber, please subscribe. I think it's the best issue that we've had yet. And we're talking about all of these trends and where the data is going and what it means for America, because we think that there's another revival here happening and it's happening under the surface. And what's interesting is the political element of it, because what you're describing is absolutely true. It's happening, but now we have the FBI in churches. So all the people who are deciding to not make the state their God, who came through COVID and on the other side of it and are going, wait a minute, that was not okay, are a danger to our current leadership.
Well, they're a danger to the new state religion. It's a state religion persecuting heretics, right? I mean,
right.
It's a tale as old as time.
Right.
The idea that we live in a secular atheistic age is nonsense if you actually look around us, right?
Yeah.
It's not a particularly original point. In fact, it's something of a cliche to say wokeness is like religion. But it is obvious, if you've been paying attention at all for the last 5 years, that we are undergoing a massive religious revival.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not the kind of Christian religious revival that we've seen in the past in American history. It's a completely different sort of pagan religion.
I call it neo-paganism because I feel
in many ways it is. In many ways it is. And yes, like in one sense, there's worship of the state, but it really, it's like the state is actually a mechanism for the ends of the
mm-hmm.
new sort of religious fervor.
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely, the FBI, the security state have been conscripted into this. And just like in any other time where there have been sort of authoritarian state churches, the heretical denominations are threats to them, right? And so you see them, yes, they're going into Catholic churches. Yes, they're persecuting pro-lifers. But they're really going after anyone who sort of subscribes to an ideological worldview, which is at odds with the basic premises of the new faith. And that isn't just true in government, although it obviously is. It's also true in the way that all of our sort of mainstream hegemonic institutions have been conscripted into being foot soldiers of the
mm-hmm.
new faith. It's an evangelical faith,
yeah.
but it's a faith that converts by the sword, not by persuasion.
It's evangelical in the same way that Sharia is evangelical,
right.
You know, submit or die.
Exactly.
And that's the totalitarianism of it is something that Carol was talking about in the last segment, which she totally understands coming from Russia. And it's interesting. We've had a couple of Chinese writers, one from China, one whose parents left China, and they're radical and they see it too. It's the people in America, at least in my experience, who are like losing their minds are the ones who've come from totalitarian regimes, whether it be, commented for the BBC for Obama's election, his first election. And this woman from Cuba came up sobbing to me. She said, "How can you not be crying? The country is over." And in some ways, like Scott McKay wrote a whole book about how we're living in Obama's heathen world right now. He started the woke stuff, or certainly it started really in the 60s, but the fruit of that, you know, poison seed really was born during Obama's time, and we're living in it now. And it is religious in nature, and it is state sponsored, certainly state enforced, maybe
both. I mean, if you look at I think one of the other conversations they're talking about this, but if you look at the funding streams from the state,
right,
it's a massive patronage networks for different sort of wings
exactly.
of the new church, right? Everything from the universities
mm-hmm.
to the massive NGO industrial complex,
right?
I mean, without going off on a tangent, the border crisis, mm-hmm. public enemy number one, is not even the Biden administration. It's this massive complex of NGOs, which enjoys
yep.
funding to the tune of billions and billions of dollars from the Biden administration.
Exactly.
Right? So mm-hmm. it's a massive sort of network. And in many ways, it complicates the question of like public versus private power, right? Conservatives for a long time have had a laudable sort of understanding of, well, you limit governments and you let the sort of private business, private enterprise do its own thing. this is a marriage between public and private power where the distinctions are gone, right?
Everything well, it's from, fascistic, actually.
Well, it, just in the technical definition of like
yes,
fascist
exactly.
political economy, it absolutely
right.
is, right?
Right.
All of society has to be marshaled towards one end, which is the enforcement of the sort of state ideology. So in some ways, it's like if you're talking about, is it coming from the state? Is it coming from these private sort of institutions? It's coming from a regime that is comprised of both of them. And it's the same people, it's the same class of people, and they move fluidly between the two, right? I mean, this is one, mm-hmm. if you look at the sort of C-suites of Silicon Valley companies, they're all from the FBI and the CIA, mm-hmm. right? And when the Biden administration started staffing up for their cabinet, they hired a bunch of people from Silicon Valley. And when the Biden administration is finished, they'll go back to Silicon Valley, right? Mm-hmm. So this idea of this sort of public-private distinction, I think in some ways is anachronistic because mm-hmm. in reality, what we're talking about is a sort of cohesive regime that exists across public and private institutions.
Well, and the interesting thing, and I've seen some people talking about this too, is it's, and I was given, and I don't know if Scott and I have talked about this, but it's certainly been on my mind a lot, that when we talk about this kind of one world government, that seems far away, conspiratorial, but in reality, the American system is hegemonic and rules the world in a way that really we haven't had an empire like this.
We are the one world government.
We are the yeah. one world government. And so like when you have, you know, rainbow flags being put up the pole in Afghanistan a month before they leave, mm-hmm. what are we doing really? You know, what's the point here? And if you've traveled outside of the United States, it's a little alarming how the cultures, the dominant culture has just melted into what we have now. And it's all controlled. And so like the messaging during COVID was the same, whether you were in Britain or Australia or Germany, like build back better. I was like, who came up with that?
Right.
You know, and why is everybody saying that? But that was, it's everywhere. So then it comes back to the individual and what we can do. So how as a young person do you feel hopeful about the future? Like, what do you see that's hopeful in all of this?
I would say I'm hopeful, not optimistic. I think, a certain amount of measured pessimism, I think, is sort of the basic mm-hmm. Conservative disposition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's true.
But I think to be hopeless is a sin, right? So you have to have a certain amount of hope. And I think the obvious fact is that things are going to continue to get much worse. In America and the West more broadly, before really there's any hope of a serious, substantial revival. But things worsening creates new opportunities that we can't even imagine yet right now. And what we need to do as conservatives, as people who are, you know, consider themselves patriots, who care about what this country was and what it could be once again, is to build infrastructure to be able to take full advantage of those opportunities when they present themselves. So a perfect example right now is what we were talking about earlier with young men moving right. A decade ago, maybe someone was talking about it, but it wasn't really something that was on people's radar. It still right. isn't really.
No, not like it should be.
And it should be. And it's going to become more and more significant, like I said, in the coming decade or two. And conservatives need to be ready to be there when young men sort of come to them. And the same thing is true of sort of any number of different questions. So, you know, are we going to continue to win White House elections? I don't know, right? Like it certainly is true that I think it's harder and harder for Republicans to actually win nationwide elections mm-hmm. for a bunch of different reasons. You know, at the state level, right, you at least have a handful of red state governors who are actually starting to say, well, I don't know if we're going to win the next national election, but we can do a lot here, right? Mm-hmm. So as things continue to deteriorate, to use the Marxian formulation, you sort of heighten the contradictions, right? So as things get worse, it opens up new coalitions, new possibilities, new opportunities. And I think you're starting to see a lot of people on the right start to become cognizant of that and actually take advantage of it. So that, I think, is what makes me optimistic, is before we can even have a hope of confronting the left, we need the right to get its priorities in order and actually to understand the moment that they're in. And I'm starting to see, I think we're all starting to see over the last few years, some evidence that that's actually happening. And that's the first step to actually winning long term.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't have awareness of where we're at and what the problem is, and I do think that a lot of long term elected officials are having a hard time. really grasping and accepting where we're at. I've seen this over and over again with some of my dear friends who have given their lives since, you know, working in the Reagan administration or whatever, and still not fully understanding what we're dealing with. And until you accept it, first off, you have to be aware, until you accept it, you cannot take any meaningful action to deal with what is. And so I think maybe at long last, I thought everybody would wake up with COVID, with our friends and neighbors being totalitarians. What alarmed me is some people on the right being like, yeah, we should fire people who won't get the COVID vaccine. I'm like, who are you? What is wrong with you? This is just like fundamentally evil.
Right.
And so like now that people have come out of that haze, and things have gotten worse, maybe at long last, there'll be some awareness and some, willingness to take some meaningful action. I hope so. The problem is that we, there's no hope if people on the right, at least don't acknowledge what's happening.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Okay. Do we have any questions or anything? Okay. Well, okay. So Nate, if I was not confident, which I was 100% confident, so this is not a, this is, would be a theoretical thing about hiring you. I'm 100%. And you know, if there's more than 100%, which there's not, confident that you have found the right home here at the American Spectator. I'm so glad that you're writing for us. I'm so glad that you're going to be part of the team. I'm so glad that you're here today. Tell everybody where they can find you online, because they're going to want to know now where they can, if they haven't seen and know who you are yet, where they can find your information.
Well, hopefully they can find me in the pages of the American Spectator soon.
Bad
eyes. But other than that, the main platform I use for my sins is Twitter, now X. So at NJ Hockman on Twitter.
NJ Hockman. Yeah. That's where he is. That's where I see him all the time. Not really. I'm excited. So anyways, like and subscribe to the American Spectator. That is on, we're on every single kind of media platform that we can be on. YouTube doesn't like us. Big shocker there. And but everywhere else where you can get videos. So like if you're on Spotify or iTunes or Rumble or X, you can find our stuff there. Thank you for watching today. I hope you're encouraged. I hope you've been given some concrete things that you can do for your children, for the culture, for yourself. And like and share all of this. Please follow Nate on X. You can follow me on X and follow the Spectator and Spectator on X as well. So thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.